No one had found a way to add sound to moving pictures, but there was a sound that was particularly associated with Holywood. It was the sound of nails being hammered. Holywood had gone critical. New houses, new streets, new neighbourhoods appeared overnight. And in those areas where the hastily educated alchemical apprentices were not yet fully alongside the trickier stages of making octocellulose, disappeared even faster. Not that it made a lot of difference. Barely would the smoke have cleared before someone was hammering again. And Holywood grew by fission. All you needed was a steady-handed, non-smoking lad who could read alchemical signs, a handle man, a sackful of demons, and lots of sunshine. Oh, and some people. But there were plenty of those. If you couldn't breed demons, or mix chemicals, or turn a handle rhythmically, you could always hold horses, or wait on tables, and look interesting while you hoped. Or, if all else failed, hammer nails. Building after rickety building skirted the ancient hill, their thin planks already curling and bleaching in the pitiless sun. But there was already a pressing need for more. Because Holywood was calling. More people arrived every day. They didn't come to be ostlers or tavern wenches or short-order carpenters. They came to make movies. And they didn't know why. As cut-me-own-throat Dibbler knew in his heart, wherever two or more people are gathered together, someone will be trying to sell them a suspicious sausage in a bun. Now that Dibbler was in fact engaged elsewhere, others had arisen to fulfil that function. One such was Nodar Borgel the Clachian, whose huge, echoing shed wasn't so much a restaurant as a feeding factory. Great steaming tureens occupied one end. The rest of it was tables, and around the tables were... Victor was astonished. There were trolls, humans, and dwarfs. And a few gnomes. And perhaps even a few elves. The most elusive of Discworld races. And lots of other things which Victor had to hope were trolls dressed up, because if they weren't, everyone was going to be in a lot of trouble. And they were all eating. And the amazing thing was that they were not eating one another.
"You take a plate, and you queue up, and then you pay for it," said Ginger. "It's called self-surf."
"You pay for it before you eat? What happens if it's dreadful?"
Ginger nodded grimly.
"That's why."
Victor shrugged and leaned down to the dwarf behind the lunch counter.
"I'd like..."
"It's stew," said the dwarf.
"What kind of stew?"
"There ain't more than one kind, that's why it's stew," the dwarf snapped. "Stew is stew."
"What I meant was, what's in it?" said Victor.
"If you need to ask, you're not hungry enough," said Ginger.
"Two stews, Frontkin."
Victor stared at the grey-brown stuff that was dribbled onto his plate. Strange lumps, carried to the surface by mysterious convection currents, bobbed for a moment, and then sank back down, hopefully forever. Borgel belonged to the Dibbler school of cuisine.
"It's stew or nothing, boy," the cook leered. "Half a dollar, cheap at half the price."
Victor handed over the money with reluctance, and looked around for Ginger.
"Over here," said Ginger, sitting down at one of the long tables. "Hi, Thunderfoot. Hi, Breccia. How's it going? This is Vic, new boy. Hi, Snidden. Didn't see you there."
Victor found himself wedged between Ginger and a mountain troll in what looked like chainmail, but turned out to be just Holywood chainmail, which was inexpertly knitted string painted silver. Ginger started talking animatedly to a 4-inch-high gnome and a dwarf in one half of a bear outfit, leaving Victor feeling a little isolated. The troll nodded at him, and then grimaced at its plate.
"They call this pumice," he said. "They never even bother to cut the lava off, and you can't even taste the sand."
Victor stared at the troll's plate.
"I didn't know trolls ate rock," he said, before he could stop himself.
"Why not?"
"Well, aren't you made of it?"
"Yeah, but you're made of meat. And what do you eat?"
Victor looked at his own plate.
"Good question," he said.
"Vic's doing a click for silverfish," said Ginger, turning around. "It looks like they're going to make it a 3-reeler.
There was a general murmur of interest. Victor carefully laid something yellow and wobbly on the side of his plate.
"Tell me," he said thoughtfully, "while you've been filming, have any of you had a... heard a sort of, felt that you were..."
He hesitated. They were all looking at him.
"I mean, did you ever feel something was acting through you? I can't think of any other way to put it."
His fellow diners relaxed.
"That's just Holywood," said the troll. "It gets you. It's all this creativity sloshing about."
"That was a pretty bad attack you had, though," said Ginger.
"Happens all the time," said the dwarf reflectively. "It's just Holywood. Last week me and the lads were working on Tales of the Dwarfies, and suddenly we all started singing just like that. Just like this. This song came into our heads all at once. What do you think of that?"
"What song?" said Ginger.
"Search me. We just call it the Hi-Ho song. That's all it was. Hi-Ho, 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 Hi-Ho."
"Sounds like every other dwarf song I ever did hear," rumbled the troll.
It was past 2 o'clock when they got back to the moving picture-making place. The handleman had the back off the picture box and was scraping at its floor with a small shovel. Dibbler was asleep in his canvas chair with a handkerchief over his face, but Silverfish was wide awake.
"Where have you two been?" he shouted.
"I was hungry," said Victor.
"And you'll jolly well stay hungry, my lad, because—"
Dibbler lifted the corner of his handkerchief.
"Let's get started," he muttered.
"But we can't have performers telling us what—"
"Finish the click, then sack him," said Dibbler.
Right. Silverfish waved a threatening finger at Victor and Ginger. "You'll never work in this town again."
They got through the afternoon somehow. Dibbler made them bring a horse in and cursed the handleman because the picture box still couldn't be moved around. The demons complained, so they put the horse head on in front of the box, and Victor bounced up and down in the saddle. As Dibbler said, it was good enough for moving pictures. Afterwards, Silverfish very grudgingly paid them $2 each and dismissed them.
"He'll tell all the other alchemists," said Ginger dispiritedly. "They'll stick together like glue."
"I notice we only get $2 a day, but the trolls get 3, said Victor. "Why is that?"
"Because there aren't so many trolls wanting to make moving pictures," said Ginger, "and a good handleman can get $6 or $7 a day. Performers aren't important."
She turned and glared at him.
"I was doing okay," she said. "Nothing special, but okay. I was getting quite a lot of work. People thought I was reliable. I was building a career."
"You can't build a career on Holywood," said Victor. "That's like building a house on a swamp. Nothing's real."
"I liked it, and now you've spoiled it all. And I'll probably have to go back to a horrible little village you've probably never even heard of. Back to bloody milkmaiding. Thanks very much. Every time I see a cow's ass, I'll think of you."
She stormed off in the direction of the town, leaving Victor with the trolls. After a while, Rock cleared his throat.
"You got anywhere to stay?" he said.
"I don't think so," said Victor weakly.
"There's never enough places to stay," said Murray.
"I thought I might sleep on the beach," said Victor. "It's warm enough, after all. I think I really could do with a good rest. Good night."
He tottered off in that direction. The sun was setting, and a wind off the sea had cooled things a little. Around the darkening bulk of the hill, the lights of Holywood were being lit. Holywood only relaxed in the darkness. When your raw material is daylight, you don't waste it. It was pleasant enough on the beach. No one much went there. The driftwood, cracked and salt-crusted, was no good for building. It was stacked in a long white row on the tide line. Victor pulled together enough to make a fire and lay back and watch the surf. From the top of the next dune, hidden behind a dry clump of grass, Gaspode the Wonder Dog watched him thoughtfully. It was 2 hours after midnight. It had them now, and poured joyfully out of the hill, poured its glitter into the world. Holywood dreams. It dreams for everyone. In the hot, breathless darkness of a clapboard shack, Ginger Withell dreamed of red carpets and cheering crowds. And a grating. She kept coming back to a grating in the dream, where a rush of warm air blew up her skirts. In the not much cooler darkness of a marginally more expensive shack, Silverfish, the moving picture smith, dreamed of cheering crowds and someone giving him a prize for the best moving picture ever made. It was a great big statue. Out in the sand dunes, Rock and Murray dozed fitfully, because trolls are night creatures by nature, and sleeping in darkness bruised the instincts of eons. They dreamed of mountains. Down on the beach under the stars, Victor dreamed of pounding hooves, flowing robes, pirate ships, sword fights, chandeliers. On the next dune, Gaspode the Wonder Dog slept with one eye open and dreamed of wolves. But Cut-Me-Own-Throat Dibbler was not dreaming, because he was not asleep. It had been a long ride to Ankh Morpork, and he preferred selling horses to riding them, but he was there now. The storms that so carefully avoided Holywood didn't worry about Ankh Morpork, and it was pouring with rain. That didn't stop the city's nightlife, though. It just made it damper. There was nothing you couldn't buy in Ankh Morpork, even in the middle of the night. Dibbler had a lot of things to buy. He needed posters painted, he needed all sorts of things. Many of them involved ideas he'd had to invent in his head on the long ride, and now had to explain very carefully to other people. And he had to explain it fast. The rain was a solid curtain when he finally staggered out into the grey light of dawn. The gutters overflowed. Along the rooftops, repulsive gargoyles threw up expertly over passers-by, although since it was now 5 a.m. the crowd had thinned out a bit. Throat took a deep breath of the thick city air. Real air. You'd have to go a long way to find air that was realer than Ankh Morpork air. You could tell just by breathing it that other people had been doing the same thing for thousands of years. For the first time in days, he felt that he was thinking clearly. That was the strange thing about Holywood. When you were there, it all seemed natural. It all seemed just what life was all about. But when you got away from it and looked back, it was like looking at a brilliant soap bubble. It was as though when you were in Holywood, you weren't quite the same person. Well, Holywood was Holywood, and Ankh was Ankh. And Ankh was solid, and proof, in Throat's opinion, against any Holywood weirdness. He splashed through the puddles, listening to the rain. After a while, he noticed, for the first time in his life, that it had a rhythm. Funny, you could live in a city all your life, and you had to go away and come back again before you noticed the way the rain dripping off the gutters had a rhythm all its own. Dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum. A few minutes later, Sergeant Colon and Corporal Nobbs of the Night Watch were sharing a friendly roll-up in the shelter of a doorway and doing what the Night Watch was best at, which was keeping warm and dry and staying out of trouble. They were the only witnesses to the manic figure which splashed down the dripping street, pirouetted through the puddles, grabbed a drainpipe to swing around the corner, and clicking its heels together merrily, disappeared from view. Sergeant Colon handed the soggy dog end back to his companion.
"Was that old Throat, Dibbler?"
he said after a while.
"Yeah,"
said Nobby.
"He looked happy, didn't he?" "Must be off his nut, if you ask me," said Nobby, "singing in the rain like that."
Vroom, vroom, vroom. The Arch-Chancellor, who had been updating his dragon stud book and enjoying a late-night drink in front of the fire, looked up. "Vroom. Hum, hum, hum. By gods," he muttered, and wandered over to the big pot. It was actually wobbling from side to side, as if the building was shaking. The Arch-Chancellor watched, fascinated. Hum, 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 hum. It wobbled to a standstill and went silent.
"Odd," said the Arch-Chancellor. "Damned odd."
Blip. On the other side of the room, his brandy decanter shattered. Rid Cully the Brown took a deep breath.
Bursa!
Victor was woken up by sandflies. The air was already warm. It was going to be another fine day. He waded out into the shallows to wash and clear his head. Let's see, he still had his $2 from yesterday, plus a handful of pennies. He could afford to stay a while, especially if he slept on the beach. And Borgel's stew, while only food in the technical sense, was cheap enough. Although, come to think of it, eating there might involve embarrassing encounters with Ginger. He took another step and sank. Victor hadn't swum in the sea before. He surfaced half-drowned, treading water furiously. The beach was only a few yards away. He relaxed, gave himself time to get his breath back, and swam a leisurely crawl out beyond the breakers. The water was crystal clear. He could see the bottom shelving away sharply to... He surfaced for a quick breath. A dim blueness in which it was just possible through the teeming shoals of fish to see the outline of pale rectangular rocks scattered on the sand. He tried a dive, fighting his way down until his ears clanged. The largest lobster he had ever seen waved its feelers at him from a rocky spire and snapped away into the depths. Victor bobbed up again, gasping, and struck out for the shore. Well, if you couldn't make it in moving pictures, there was an opening here for a fisherman, that was certain. A beachcomber would do all right as well. There was enough wind-dried firewood piled up on the edge of the dunes to keep Ankh-Morpork's fires supplied for years. No one in Holywood would dream of lighting a fire except for cooking or company. And someone had been doing just that. As he waded ashore, Victor realized that the wood further along the beach had been stacked not haphazardly, but apparently by design, in neat piles. Further along, stones had been stacked into a crude fireplace. It was clogged with sand. Maybe someone else had been living on the beach, waiting their big chance in moving pictures. Come to think of it, the timber behind the half-buried stones had a dragged-together look. You could imagine, looking at it from the sea, that several bulks of timber had been set up to form an arched doorway. Perhaps they were still there. Perhaps they might have something to drink. They were indeed still there. But they hadn't needed a drink for months. It was 8 in the morning. A thunderous knocking awoke Bizam Planter, owner of the Odium, one of Ankh-Morpork's mushrooming crop of moving picture pits. He'd had a bad night. The people of Ankh-Morpork liked novelty. The trouble was that they didn't like novelty for long. The Odium had done great business for a week, had broken even for the next week, and was now dying. The late showing last night had been patronized by one deaf dwarf and an orangutan who'd brought along his own peanuts. Bizam relied on the sale of peanuts and banged grains for his profit, and wasn't in a good mood. He opened the door and stared out blearily.
"We're shut till 2 o'clock," he said. "Matney, come back then. Seats in all parts."
He slammed the door. It rebounded off Throat Dibbler's boot and hit Bizam on the nose.
"I've come about the special showing of Sword of Passion," said Throat.
"Special showing? What special showing?"
"The special showing I'm about to tell you about," said Throat.
"We ain't showing nothing about any special passionate swords. We're showing the exciting..."
"Mr. Dibbler says you're showing Sword of Passion," rumbled a voice.
Throat leaned against the doorway. Behind him was a slab of rock. It looked as though someone had been throwing steel balls at it for 30 years. It creased in the middle and leaned down towards Bizam. He recognized Detritus. Everyone recognized Detritus. He wasn't a troll, you forgot.
"But I haven't even heard of..."
Throat pulled a large tin from under his coat and grinned.
"And here are some posters," he added, producing a fat white roll.
"Mr. Dibbler, let me stick some up on walls," said Detritus proudly.
Bizam unrolled the poster. It was in eye-watering colours. It showed a picture of what might just possibly be Ginger, pouting in a blouse too small for her, and Victor in the act of throwing her over one shoulder while fighting an assortment of monsters with the other hand. In the background, volcanoes were erupting, dragons were zooming through the sky, and cities were burning down.
"The motion picture they could not ban," read Bizam hesitantly. "A scorching adventure in the white-hot dawn of a new continent. A man and a woman thrown together in the whirlpool of a world gone mad. Staring Dolores Dacin as the woman, and Victor Maraschino as Cohen the Barbarian. Thrills adventure, Helliphants. Coming soon to a pit near you."
He read it again.
"Who's staring Dolores Dacin?" he said suspiciously.
"That's starring," said Throat. "That's why we've put stars against their names, see?"
He leaned closer and lowered his voice to a piercing whisper.
"They do say," he said, "that she's the daughter of a Clachian pirate and his wild headstrong captive, and he's the son of a rogue wizard and a reckless gypsy flamenco dancer."
"Cool," said Bizam, impressed despite himself. Dibbler permitted himself a mental slap on the back. He'd been quite taken with it himself.
"I reckon you should start showing it in about an hour," he said.
"At this time in the morning," said Beezam.
The clique he had obtained for the day was an exciting study of pottery making, which had been worrying him. This seemed a much better proposition.
"Yes," said Dibbler, "because a lot of people are going to want to watch it."
"I dunno about that," said Beezam. "Houses have been falling off lately."
"They'll want to watch this one," said Throat. "Trust me, have I ever lied to you?"
Beezam scratched his head.
"Well, one night last month, you sold me a sausage in a bun, and you said..."
"I was speaking rhetorically," snapped Throat.
"Yeah," said Detritus.
Beezam sagged.
"Oh, well, I don't know about rhetorically," he said.
"Right,"
said Throat, grinning like a predatory pumpkin.
"Just you open up and you can sit back and rake in the money."
"Oh, good," said Beezam weakly.
Throat put a friendly arm around the man's shoulders.
"And now," he said, "let's talk about percentages."
"What are percentages?"
"Have a cigar," said Throat.
Victor walked slowly up Holywood's nameless main street. There was packed sand under his fingernails. He wasn't sure that he'd done the right thing. Probably the man had just been some old beachcomber who'd just gone to sleep one day and hadn't woken up. Although the stained red and gold coat was unusual beachcombing wear, it was hard to tell how long he'd been dead. The dryness and salt air had been a preservative. They'd preserved him just the way he must have looked when he was alive, which was like someone who was dead. By the look of his hut, he'd beachcombed some odd stuff. It had occurred to Victor that someone ought to be told. But there was probably no one in Holywood who would be interested. Probably only one person in the world had been interested in whether the old man lived or died, and he'd been the first to know. Victor buried the body in the sand, landward of the driftwood hut. He saw Borgles ahead of him. He'd risk breakfast there, he decided. Besides, he needed somewhere to sit down and read the book. It wasn't the sort of thing you expected to find on a beach, in a driftwood hut, clutched in the hand of a dead man. On the cover were the words, "The Book of the Film." On the first page, in the neat round hand of someone to whom writing doesn't come easily, were the further words, "This is the chronicle of the keepers of the Paramountain, copied out by me, Deccan, Beau Coors, of the old one, it being falling apart." He turned the stiff pages carefully. They seemed to be crammed with almost identical entries. They were all undated, but that wasn't very important, since one day had been pretty much like the other. "Got up, went to lavatory, made up fire, announced the matinee performance, broke fast, collected wood, made up fire, foraged on the hilly, chanted the evening performance, supper, said the late night performance, chant, went to lavatory bed. Got up, went to lavatory, made up fire, said the matinee performance, broke fast. Crullet the fisherman from Jowser Cove, have left two fine sea bass. Collected wood, heralded the evening performance, made up fire. Housekeeping, supper. Chanted the late night performance, bed. Got up at midnight, went to lavatory. Checked fire, but it was not needful of wood." He saw the waitress out of the tail of his eye.
"I'd like a boiled egg," he said.
"It's stew. Fish stew."
He looked up into Ginger's blazing eyes.
"I didn't know you were a waitress," he said.
She made a show of dusting the salt bowl.
"Nor did I until yesterday," she said. "Lucky for me, Borgle's regular morning girl got a chance in the new moving picture that untied alchemists are making, isn't it?" She shrugged. "If I'm really lucky, who knows, I might get to do the afternoon shift too."
"Look, I didn't mean..."
"It's stew. Take it or leave it. Three customers this morning have done both."
"I'll take it. Look, you won't believe it, but I found this book in the hands of a..."
"I'm not allowed to dally with customers. This isn't the best job in town, but you're not losing it for me,"
snapped Ginger. Fish stew, right?
Oh, right. Sorry.
He flicked backwards through the pages. Before Deccan, there was Tanto, who also chanted three times a day, and also sometimes received gifts of fish, and also went to the lavatory, although either he wasn't so assiduous about it as Deccan, or hadn't thought it always worth writing down. Before that, someone called Megalyn had been the chanter. A whole string of people had lived on the beach, and then if you went back further, there was a group of them, and further still, the entries had a more official feel. It was hard to tell. They seemed to be written in code, line after line of little complex pictures. A bowl of primal soup was plonked down in front of him.
Look, he said, what time do you get off?
Never, said Ginger.
I just wondered if you might know...
No. Victor stared at the murky surface of the broth. Borgel worked on the principle that if you find it in the water, it's a fish. There was something purple in there, and it had at least 10 legs. He ate it anyway. It was costing him 30 pence. Then, with Ginger resolutely busying herself at the counter with her back to him, lighthouse fashion, so that however he tried to attract her attention, her back was still facing him without her apparently moving, he went to look for another job. Victor had never worked for anything in his life. In his experience, jobs were things that happened to other people. Bezam Planter adjusted the tray around his wife's neck.
All right, he said. Got everything?
The banged grains have gone soft, she said, and there's no way to keep the sausages hot.
It'll be dark, love. No one'll notice.
He tweaked the strap and stood back.
There, he said. Now you know what to do. Halfway through, I'll stop showing the film and put up the card that says, why not try a cool, refreshing drink and some banged grains, and then you come out of the door over there and walk up the aisle.
You might as well mention cool, refreshing sausages as well, said Mrs. Planter.
And I reckon you should stop using a torch to show people to their seats, said Bezam. You're starting too many fires.
It's the only way I can see in the dark, she said.
Yes, but I had to let that dwarf have his money back last night. You know how sensitive they are about their beers. Tell you what, love, I'll give you a salamander in a cage. They've been on the roof since dawn. They should be nice and ready.
They were. The creatures lay dozing in the bottom of their cages, their bodies vibrating gently as they absorbed the light. Bezam selected 6 of the ripest, climbed heavily back down to the projection room, and tipped them into the showing box. He wound Throat Dibbler's film onto a spool, and then peered out into the darkness. Oh well, might as well see if there was anyone outside. He shuffled to the front door, yawning. He reached up and slid the bolt. He reached down and slid the other bolt. He pulled open the doors.
All right, he grumbled. Let's be having you.
He woke up in the projection room, with Mrs. Planter fanning him desperately with her apron.
"What happened?"
he whispered, trying to put out of his mind the memories of trampling feet.
"It's a full house," she said, "and they're still queuing up outside. They're all down the street. It's them disgusting posters."
Bezam got up unsteadily, but with determination.
"Woman, shut up and get down to the kitchen and bang some more grains," he shouted, "and then come and help me repaint the signs. If they're queuing for 5-penny seats, they'll queue for 10 pence.
He rolled up his sleeves and grasped the handle. In the front row, the librarian sat with a bag of peanuts in his lap. After a few minutes, he stopped chewing and sat with his mouth open, staring and staring and staring at the flickering images.